You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And greetings and special welcome to all of our listeners in Portland, Oregon. Back on the air now on X-Ray FM, 91.1 FM. And hey, happy St. Patrick's Day. It says so in green on my... I should have worn a green sweater or something. Anyway, we had a St. Patrick's Day party. It was Saturday in the marina. It is really amazing living in a tight community of people. And, you know, we just started on Dock A. Each dock had their own kind of like themed thing. And it's just good and funky and lots of fun and, you know, genuinely a good time. Anyway. The middle class loses out on tax perks and benefits. I want to get to this. This is interesting. The Financial Times. They're talking about the British middle class, actually. You know, it was Ronald Reagan and Maggie Thatcher at the same time. And what's interesting is that the top tax rate in England used to be 50%, and a couple of years ago they dropped it down to 45% with much waving of banners and hoop-de-hooped. And now they note that under that lower tax rate, such anomalies reflect politicians' determination to avoid raising the top rate of tax, Sarah Neville and Vanessa Holder write in their article for the Financial Times titled Middle Class Loses Out on Tax Perks and Benefits. They're going just to the very rich. And then I thought this was really interesting. Professor Hills argues this may have much to do with the way Britons view their welfare state. The preceding sentence, for now the middle classes seem to be keeping faith with the benefit system and the taxation required to support it. And then this is what Professor Hill said. He said, people in Britain don't think about this in the way that an economist or an accountant would do with a column of debits and a column of credits. By and large, they support a system where what you pay in is in proportion to your income, but what you get out is according to your needs. Holy Karl Marx. Anyway, I wanted to get into a whole bunch of different things today, from sex ed to tipping. The tipping is, I think, the Crimean Peninsula, I guess it's called. Louise and I have some familiarity with this. One of our kids spent a summer, maybe a little more than a summer, in Simferopol, a city on the seacoast in Crimea. They used to have the spy school there where Carlos the Jackal was trained. And after the Soviet Union fell, they converted it into a language school because that was a big part of the spy school and opened it up to the world. And one of our kids went there to learn Russian, and she speaks quite fluent Russian and probably a little Ukrainian because it was in the Ukraine, although most of what is spoken in Crimea is Russian. And so anyhow, we have some familiarity with the area. And I'm guessing Russia's going to pick this one up pretty soon. So we'll see where that goes. I still, you know, I'm hearing much Sturm und Drang from John McCain. Nobody has answered yet the question to me, what is America's interest in this? Other than the IMF program. And we're going to try and get Naomi Klein on about that. Arkansas, in one county, they have disenfranchised 1 out of 5 absentee voters thanks to the new voter ID law. Just brilliant. And in Washington, here in Washington, D.C., a new brew pub is opening up. It's called the Public Option. And they're going to ban tipping. They're going to pay all their wait staff, all their servers, $15 an hour minimum, plus benefits, and just refuse tips. And they point out that, you know, tipping itself, the idea of tipping is, you know, you help out somebody who gives you really good service, but the reality of tipping is that it accounts for less than 1% of the behavioral change of people. As Bryce Covert writes over at the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress, While customers think the tipping system leads to better service, the two are basically unrelated. Customers' perception of service accounts for just a percentage point or so in the difference between the tips they leave. But what it does do is it promotes racism and sexism. Attractive women make better tips than men or unattractive women, and white servers make better tips than black servers, despite identical service. So, oh, and the poverty rate for restaurant workers is triple that of everyone else, or of the norm, because the minimum wage for restaurant workers is $2.13 an hour. On the assumption that they're going to make that up to $7.25 an hour with tips, and restaurants are obliged to make sure that they make that up to $7.25, but a lot of them don't. So have you ever worked for tips? Do you think that tipping is a good system or not? Now, I've eaten at restaurants, particularly since I've lived here in Washington, D.C., and gone out for meals with people who have expense accounts. It's a startling thing to see, you know, dinner for three or four people come up with a $200-$300 tab. But you think that probably that waiter's making a good living, but maybe not. Maybe they're having to share it back. I don't know. So, you know, do you think that we should be tipping? Anyhow, first they came for our economy and we said nothing. Then they came for our government and again we said nothing. And now they've come for science and we don't seem to be saying much at all. Thanks to Republican-backed austerity measures, our scientific infrastructure has been hit with a devastating budget cut. All across America, research labs are shutting their doors, scientists are joining unemployment lines, and potentially life-saving drug trials and research projects are being put on hold. But have no fear, the billionaire oligarchs are here. Yeah, as William Broad points out in the New York Times, yet from Silicon Valley to Wall Street, science philanthropy is hot, as many of the richest Americans seem to reinvent themselves as patrons of social progress through science research. Broad goes on to write that the result is a new calculus of influence and priorities that the scientific community views with a mix of gratitude and trepidation. Stephen Edwards, a policy analyst for the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences, for better or worse, the practice of science in the 21st century is becoming shaped less by national priorities or by peer review groups and more by the particular preferences of individuals with huge amounts of money. Basically, rich people, you know, whether it's disease research, underwater exploration, space travel, climate change, or climate change denial, it's all being funded by billionaires. Science and pseudoscience. And the result is that basic science research, which is really where the rubber meets. I mean, this is the real stuff. It's where the real scientific breakthroughs happen. It's not happening because the billionaires don't see basic science as anything of interest to them. Who cares? They're only funding the areas that they personally care about. Somebody in their family has leukemia, boom, they fund leukemia research. Somebody in their family has a kid with autism, boom, they fund autism research. But basic science, no. This is part of a larger puzzle. Before they had their sights aimed at science, the billionaires came for our economy. They turned it into an oligonomy. This was, you know, Ronald Reagan, the whole Reaganomics thing, recreating the Gilded Era. And then when they controlled the economy, they went after our government. And then we went from an oligonomy to an oligarchy. So now, Citizens United facilitated that. So now we have a full-blown oligarchy in government. And the proof of this is when President Obama can't even get his nominee for, you know, who's the general, the Surgeon General, through because the oligarchs at the NRA are saying, no, we don't like what this guy said. The guns are a public health issue. We're not happy with that at all. So our political system is now, you know, is the dog that's being wagged by the tail of the oligarchs. And our economic system has been that way for about 20 years, and we're basically reinventing the late 19th century. It's not good.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more of the news of the day and my take on it right after this. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Andrew Campbell, senior producer with The Big Picture, on the line with us. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. So what's up? Block A.
I'm going to start off with Richard Eskow, coming in from L.A. He's the senior fellow with Campaign for America's Future.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to be talking about America's retirement crisis, something that really has gone unreported on the mainstream media, but there's a huge crisis going on right now. And one thing people have probably heard about is that Obama reversed the chain CPI on Social Security in his budget. But that isn't the major victory that people think it is, so I'll be getting into why that is with Richard.
Okay. And then NASA. Industrial civilization is headed for an irreversible collapse?
Actually, we've had a change in Block B.
Oh, okay.
We're going to be airing a recent climate story.
Oh, okay. All right.
On a carbon tax, and what a carbon tax really, what it means for America, what it means for the world, and what it means for helping to solve the climate change problem.
Okay, great.
Yep.
And then what's coming up?
In Block C, we have Patrick Lovell. He's a filmmaker who's released a new documentary called Forward 13, Waking Up the American Dream.
Mm-hmm.
Patrick actually lost his home during the foreclosure crisis back in 2008-2009. And this documentary, it's really a great documentary. It takes a look at where we've come since then and just how we can sort of rebuild our country and sort of get back on a path where everyone has a chance to be successful.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then in Block D, we'll have the good, bad, and ugly, and we're going to get into Marianne Williamson's going to drop by.
Yep. She's the author of the bestseller book, A Return to Love, and she's also running for Congress as an independent out in California around Los Angeles. And she's got some pretty cool things on her political platform, so we'll be talking to her and what she thinks is needed to really turn America around.
Yeah, she's running for Henry Waxman's old seat.
Exactly.
Yeah. And the we're reinventing the 19th century, our daily take, basically the rant that I was just doing.
Yeah, you just got on to it before the break, but essentially the oligarchs have really taken over all aspects of our country. Most recently, we've tied it to their drive to privatize science, but it all started back during the Reagan years, giving us Reaganomics, giving us a failure to enforce the Sherman Antitrust Act. And once they had their hands on our economy, they went after the government. We've seen that with the things like the 2008 financial crisis, where they profited at the expense of working class Americans.
Yeah.
So it's a terrible thing that's happened to our country, and it's time we turn it around and kicked out the oligarchs.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny, you look all around the world, and from country to country, they're all facing crises that seem to be driven by oligarchs. It's like there's this international oligarchic conspiracy or something. You know, I'm seriously thinking in those terms. You read Krista Freeland's book, Plutocrats,
right?
And it's just amazing because she documents how it's probably 10,000-20,000 people worldwide who are billionaires, multi-billionaires, and they live in a totally insulated world. They are only marginally have contact with anybody who's not a billionaire, and all those people are, you know, deferential servants who look down at the ground a lot and fly their planes for them and things. And it's really quite remarkable. Anyhow, Andrew Gamble. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Tom.
I'll see you in a minute. We'll be right back. Past the hour. Well, let me just boil down the essential rant. In fact, actually, I think that David in St. Paul, Minnesota, listening on AM 950, wants to get into this funding for colleges and science. Hey, David, welcome.
Yeah, hey, Tom. You know, I read that article as well on the New York Times about science funding, and also on Friday, the Minneapolis Star Tribune had an article about University of Minnesota professors needing to go to Home Depot to fix their own laboratory equipment and because the equipment they have is either outdated or they don't have parts available for them anymore, and they don't have the money to fix these machines anymore.
But they got plenty of money for their sports team.
Or administrative costs, yes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, the net of all of this is that we used to fund colleges and we used to fund research. And in fact, the reason why we have $1 trillion in student loan debt in the United States right now, and we didn't when Ronald Reagan came into office. Student loan debt was, you know, wasn't even a beep on the meter of you know, national debt nationwide. There were some people who went into debt. Typically, they were people who, you know, went to school long enough to, like, get an MD. But the reason that it's changed is because back in 1980, when Reagan became president, 80% of the cost of a college education was not paid for with tuition. It was paid for by state, federal, and local funds and college endowments and the colleges themselves. 80% of the total cost of tuition. And so students paid only 20% of the cost of their education in the form of tuition. And it was, college was affordable, and it had been that way largely since the 1920s or so. And on the other hand, now, so then, you know, Reagan comes in and says, you know, government is terrible, let's cut government so that, you know, we can deregulate, we can do away with regulatory agencies so the billionaires can make more money. And part of cutting government, of course, was cutting education funding. And so now the tuition that a student pays covers 80% of the cost of running a college, and state and federal funds are only accounting for 20% of the cost of running a college. And so colleges are being run on a shoestring, and students are massively in debt. And it's just a screwed-up system. It's a totally screwed-up system. So thanks for the call. Good point. Bill in Connellsville, Pennsylvania, you wanted to talk about this is interesting. You want to talk about the tipping thing. I was asking, what do you think about tipping? Have you ever worked in a tipping environment? Hey, Bill, what's up?
Well, for years I stayed out of restaurants, but in the past 5 years or so, I've had friends that hang out in restaurants, so I go with them to restaurants, and I usually don't eat there. I just have something to drink because all these restaurants are mostly high-carb things anyway. But my point about the tipping is I go, like, to the local McDonald's, and I see those people working there, and they're working hard, and they're working fast-paced, and they're doing multitasking, and they don't get tips. They don't expect tips. And then you go to a so-called fancy restaurant, and these people, you know, and they work hard too. You know, they deserve to be paid properly, but you have to pay part of their salary, basically, and they do get tips. So for years, my opinion has been that tipping should be not allowed, that all workers should be paid accordingly to, you know, and equally. And so, no, I think tipping is a bad idea. I really do.
Yeah, it took me, you know, we lived in Germany for a year back in the 80s, and it took me a long time to get used to tipping in restaurants. And I really got it in my face once when a waiter actually gave me back some of my tip because it was so large it was an insult to him. And the way it works there is that, you know, servers are paid well and they get good benefits and they have health programs and all this kind of stuff. And so basically when you leave a tip, if you get normal service, when you get your change back, you just kind of leave the change on the table. You know, if you, and I'm talking, you know, like 50, 80 cents kind of change, you know, whatever rounds to the next dollar. And if you got really exceptional tip service, you might leave a dollar or $2 or $3. Or back then it was Deutsche Marks and now it'd be euros, but, you know, still on the table. And if you try to tip 15, 20% like Americans do, it's, I mean, in the tourist places, they will gladly take your money, but it's pretty shocking to them. And like I said, this one guy, he like I was patronizing him or something, or I was trying to play big shot or billionaire or something. And he was insulted by it. And I mean, this was in a little town in Germany, but they keep the tipping tradition for really extraordinary service, but by and large, you don't tip or you tip very minimally. It's one of the reasons why restaurant workers in New York and other cities that have a lot of tourists coming through from Europe hate European visitors, because European visitors are notoriously bad tippers because they assume that people in America are paid the same way Europeans are paid. And when we travel to Europe, we assume that their wait staff is paid the same way we are. It's an interesting thing.
And, yeah. You know, another thing, too, I knew a girl that worked for years in the restaurant business, and she told me that people that come into restaurants, regular customers, if they get a reputation for not tipping or not tipping enough, they will notoriously give them poor service.
Yeah.
And that's kind of wrong.
Yeah. Well, and the flip side of that is that if you overtip, there's a couple of restaurants here in town that Louise and I go to fairly regularly when we have an opportunity to have a business meeting with somebody or somebody, you know, there is, and I'll always try to leave a few extra bucks on the table beyond what has, you know, would be a normal tip. Or if somebody else is picking up the tab, which happens fairly frequently, then I'll leave a little bit. just because those are regular restaurants and those people recognize us and, you know, want, I'd like the good service, but it shouldn't have to be that way. It's almost, you know, it's almost like you're buying something. On the other hand,
yeah,
I don't know. It's just, it's the way it's done in America. I guess, you know, we're kind of used to it. You know, it's the water that we, that we swim in that we don't notice. So, Bill, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for watching us there in Connellsville, Pennsylvania. Oh, 10 seconds? I was going to grab another caller. But this Public Option is the new restaurant here in D.C. that is going to be paying their servers $15 an hour plus benefits, and they will not allow tipping. Now, there was another restaurant that was mentioned in this article that has started just Sushi Yasuda. They just add 18%. No, I'm sorry. That's not the restaurant. They don't take tips either. There's another one on the West Coast that said that they ban tipping, but they charge a flat 18% on their checks for service. And then that is what they use to pay their wait staff. So, I don't think that that's so good, because then you've got the waiters who are being incentivized to try and talk you into ordering larger portions and more expensive meals, which I guess from a restaurant's point of view is a good thing, but not from mine. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Should we change tipping? And how do we change how we fund our schools and our basic science research in this country? I think we have to just roll back Reaganomics. 28 minutes before the hour. Welcome back to your media support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. John in Highbridge, New Jersey, you own a restaurant?
I do own a restaurant, Tom.
So your take on tipping, sir?
Well, my take on tipping, at $15 an hour, all of my staff would be most distressed if they were not to receive tips, because they're, you know, with tips, we pay all of our servers minimum wage or better.
Right. Okay.
Which is, you know, one of the problems I have with the restaurant business is, you know, they pay that one, whatever,
$2.13 an hour, yeah.
Yeah, that didn't strike me as fair, so we do much better than that. But at $15 an hour, they would be taking a dramatic pay cut.
Okay, so you're one of those higher-end restaurants where, you know, I'm paying the check and I'm thinking, boy, this guy's making more money than I am.
No, actually, I run an Irish bar and grill.
Uh-huh. What's your average check, do you know?
My average check, our average cover is about $25.
Okay, per person.
Per person.
So at 20%, that would be around $4 around a $4.25 tip, right?
On 25, but generally, because our prices are so reasonable, people leave, you know, 25-30% generally.
Oh, that's interesting. So your tip value is higher than normal too. Do you find that the more people drink, the better they tip?
That's definitely true.
I've often wondered about that. I've had waiters and waitresses really aggressively push the booze. And I've also noticed some restaurants really pour much better than others. And I wondered if that was a, you know, okay, we'll lose a little bit of having, you know, three glasses of wine per bottle instead of four, but we'll make it up in tips. Although the restaurant doesn't make it up. The servers do.
Yeah, servers do try to do that. I mean, I've been on both sides, you know, the back of the house and the front of the house.
Yeah.
And, you know, that will happen, but that's management's job to control that.
Sure. What do you think about the European model where the company pays not just minimum wage, but a good living wage? Basically, servers make in a restaurant the same as anybody else in the restaurant, you know, management, not necessarily senior management, but, you know, basically they make a good middle-class living and with full benefits and sick days and all those kind of things. And then the tip is just for outstanding service.
I think that that's fine as long as you can get the public to understand the change in the business paradigm.
Yeah.
I mean, you would have to, you know, change your pricing structure for that to make up for that compensation.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
okay.
It changes the whole business dramatically.
Yeah, I can imagine. John, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Thanks for watching us. Rose in Pompano Beach, Florida. Hey, Rose, you have been a waiter for years and you want...
A waitress,
okay. Right. And you want to comment on tipping.
Yeah, I waitress for close to 50 years. I'm retired now.
Mm-hmm.
I originally come from Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I waitress there. And then I come down here and waitressed up until 4 years ago. And
in
I absolutely
Florida.
Believe in tipping.
Uh-huh. Now...
Yeah, I wouldn't have made it without tipping.
Yeah.
I raised three kids. You know, I was a single parent. I raised three kids.
Wow. Now, could you have made it if your employer had simply paid you a decent wage?
Well, no, because what I did was I left for a couple of months and went to MIT, mm-hmm. and that was 30-something years ago, and they were paying me over $10 an hour there. My brother got me the job, and I couldn't do it. After taxes, I was bringing home about $270 a week, and I couldn't do it.
Right.
I was working 30 hours a week, and I was making like $500 a week.
Wow.
$550, and I was working just lunches, Nick's Beef and Beer in Mass Ave in Cambridge. They were there for years.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely on tipping. Absolutely.
Right. Now, one of the points that the people who are against tipping make is that if somebody is not an attractive woman or white,
I never found that.
They make less money on tips.
BS.
So you've worked with
I've worked with women that were, you know, attractive, weren't attractive. Myself, well, I was very attractive.
Uh-huh.
And their personalities and all, they made just as much money, if not more, than me.
Huh. Okay. And
I remember one woman I started working with, and she was another job that I had, Madeline. Mm-hmm. She was like, then she was in her 60s, heavy, great personality. I was young, 38, and I used to say, Madeline, how do you do it? She says, you got to smile more. But looks have nothing to do with it.
Yeah, it's like, you know, my son, just occurred to me I shouldn't tell that story. But anyway, I think that, you know, one of the things I've always liked is at Waffle House down in, when we lived in Atlanta, the waitresses would always call you sweetie and honey, and, you know, they were, and I don't mean that I liked that specifically, but just there was this real sense of friendly Southern, you know, and it's
right.
A Waffle House. I mean, you know, it's not like a high-end restaurant or anything, but it was just always, you know, very casual and very friendly. That's interesting. Thanks for the call, Rose. And have a great day there in Florida. Sorry, say what? No, okay. David in Chicago, listening to WCPT. You wanted to talk about our funding science. That was my more serious topic for this hour, and I think it's a real serious one.
I just want to bring to your listeners and your attention two, I think, very seminal papers or books. One is by Daniel S. Greenberg, Science, Money, and Politics, Political Triumph and Ethical Erosion. And that was written, I think, around 2003, 2004. And then a paper written by the National Bureau of Economic Research, I believe associated with MIT, but Eric Weinstein wrote this paper some time ago. And the title of the paper was How and Why Government, Universities, and Industry Create Domestic Labor Shortages of Scientists and High-Tech Workers. And it goes back to the National Science Foundation, where Eric Block and Peter House basically conspired with a bogus study saying that there was going to be a shortage of demographic shortage of scientists and STEM workers. So that's how come we have to, you know, bring in more foreign workers. This was around 1990, 1988. And so Representative Volpe back then saw the study. And if you read the hearing, he just thoroughly excoriates this bogus paper. Mm. But this was the premise upon which to passed the H-1B visa law in 1990 and flood the market. So now what you're doing is, remember, it's all about personnel, right?
Right.
So if you disincentivize Americans to go into science and technology in order to drive down wages, to create policies that will drive down wages, you're not going to be incentivizing Americans to go into the STEM field and to get a PhD, because by the time they spend that 4 or 5 years getting a graduate degree, they have lost income, and then they're only going to make $60,000-$70,000 a year instead of the six-figure income that you would think a premium on a PhD would command, especially in the STEM field.
Right. STEM is an acronym for what? Science, technology, engineering?
Technology, engineering, math.
Math, okay. I couldn't remember that.
In fact, if you really want to get a prescient view of this, go back, you can Google Edith Holleman, H-O-L-L-E-M-A-N, who gave two speeches in 1994 in Phoenix in September, and then in March of 1995, where she basically gives the same speech. And the speech was Engineers and Employment in the Global Economy, where she predicted, in part, the very dysfunctionality and the denigration of STEM workers in our country.
But see, if we had simply refused to increase the H-1B visas, to increase the number of foreign engineers who could come into the United States.
Yes.
One argument that is made, and I was in India. I was in Bombay, Mumbai, and I forget the name of the town now. But anyway, I was in India when Microsoft, this was back a decade or more ago, Microsoft was doing a jobs fair, a hiring fair down in Bangalore, down in the southern part of India. And they were saying that they were going to hire, my recollection is that they were going to hire something like 50,000 engineers and they were paying $10,000 a year. Now, it might be that they're going to hire 10,000 engineers and they were paying $50,000 a year. I don't think so, but whatever it was, that's my recollection. I'm not asserting that as a fact, but they were hiring some mind-boggling number of engineers, and they were paying, and they were looking for a minimum master's degree, and they had, 10, 20, 100 people applying for every job, because India is a large country. I mean, they have three times the population of the United States. There's a lot of college graduates in that country, and wages are quite low. Cost of living is quite low, and it particularly was back in the early 90s when I was there. And so how do you deal with that? How do you fight that if they simply close their R&D departments here and move them to India?
Well, ostensibly, in fact, that's what General Electric did. I mean, because Jack Welch was the pioneer in offshoring on this. He's the guilty party on this.
Oh.
Wall Street Journal has written about this. But you have to look at the educational system. The elites, the educational public policy elites in China and India have been complaining that they're graduating these engineers and scientists, but they don't know how to think. They don't know creative. They're not learning creative problem solving. They're
right.
just reading or memorizing to the test.
Right.
And as a result, you're getting people who can take a test, but they really don't have the creative problem solving and communication that you need in these complex workflow environments. And the idea of breaking it up like Frederick Taylor tried to do on the mechanistic production line is insane when it comes to software development. And yet that's what these accountants have been trying to do with these high-skilled jobs in these cheap labor markets in the third world.
So we need to go back to localization of everything and make it difficult for companies to move their operation overseas merely for the price of arbitrage of labor, or merely for the purpose of it.
I don't know if you can, but there's a lot more to talk about on this.
Yeah, I agree with you, David. David, thanks a lot for the call. 15 minutes before we leave.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
See, this keeps things keep always coming back to why can't we just repeal the 80s, basically? Roll back the Reaganomics. Amazing. And welcome back. Let's see here. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, what's on your mind?
I like to talk about education, but first let me tell you what I heard. Have you heard what I heard about Mitt Romney?
It depends on what you heard.
I heard that he's going to buy all the Waffle House chains because then if he decides to run again, his corporate experience will more fit his personal experience.
What does that mean?
Waffle House. You know how he waffled?
Oh, it was a joke. Okay. I thought you meant he'd go into the Waffle Houses and campaign and be like the guy of the people.
And if he runs again and they criticize him for being a waffler, he can say, look,
I got
you guys go in there and eat the pancakes.
You know, I think he might run again. I do think that the Republican candidate in 2016 is going to be Jeb Bush. I would place money on that right now. But I wouldn't rule out Mitt Romney.
He's part of the Reagan-Bush crime family.
Yep.
Clinton, Bush, Reagan. I mean, the same... They're all associated with the same thugs in my
opinion. I think it's going to be Clinton versus Bush in 2016.
And I think that
whoever's the vice presidential candidate on those two tickets is going to be the person who is either going to get or repel the base. But, who knows? Who knows?
Isn't it really tragic that this far ahead we're already talking about the fixes in. I mean, I guess the only thing I'm thinking, the only hope is the way I look at it, more and more people are waking up on your show, even the neocons that listen to the blimp, Limbaugh.
Mm.
And they're waking up that it's a fixed game. It's all rigged. free trade's a scam. It's a sham. You could educate everybody. We could make them all doctors like Cuba. You need to see the movie. It was the most enlightening thing I've ever seen. It's called Cuba's Secrets. And it's very honest. And that's the problem you have with free trade. We're going to get to Cuba's standard with free trade. And the oligarchs are going to get even richer. But the problem is, I wouldn't want to live like that because you got two classes of people down there. Since they've opened it up, if you see the movie, it's really good. It's a documentary.
Okay.
You'll see that the people that live down there, they're doctors and they're very educated and you know, they spend all this gross national product, the majority for education. They're all smart, but they live in condos where the sewage is in the open sewage with maggots eating it in the ground floor. They have to scrap every day for enough food to eat. Then you got the other side where they let the tourists in and the teachers from America and all the people that can go down there and vacation. They don't let those people, they're protected by the waterfront. There's two societies down there, and they don't let the people that live down there, the educated people that are in just dire straits poverty. I mean, it's just terrible. They don't have sewage. They don't have clean water. They don't have food. They don't have air conditioning.
It sounds like a video that was made by Marco Rubio's friends.
No, Tom, listen, you're a good man, Tom. Please, Tom, please. I saw it, and I couldn't believe it. I was looking for that corporate, that little, you know, the camel under the tent, corporate, you know,
sure,
bias. But it was the most.
You should get down to Cuba, Armin. We should both go to Cuba. We should check it out together. I'm curious. I am not asserting anything about Cuba because I've never been there, and I really believe in talking about what you know about. I don't know anything about Cuba. I want to go. So maybe Armin, one of these days, we'll get down to Cuba together. How's that?
Come with me. We'll go, bro.
Okay. Thanks a lot. We'll talk to you soon. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you. And Jefferson Smith on the line with me. Jefferson Smith is one of the principals in the new X-Ray, X-R-A-Y, FM, .FM is the website, actually. And X-Ray FM is the radio station in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Jefferson.
Hey, buddy. How you doing, man?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you?
Right now, I am driving. At this very moment, I'm pulled over at some version of strip mall. Enjoying beautiful sunshine between Seattle and Vancouver, BC, heading up to the TED Active Conference on the first weekday of the KXRY X-Ray FM programmatic launch. Feeling awesome on many counts and even more delighted to be here talking with you.
Well, thank you. So you guys have launched a small, as in low power, community FM radio station in Portland. You put up a Kickstarter campaign to get this thing going, trying to raise $40,000. You ended up raising over $100,000. The community's really with you. You've got an incredible programming lineup. What would you say to the people who might be listening online in areas where there is no progressive radio on the air and who would like to start something like that? What's your message to them?
Give me a call. my cell phone number is 971-275-2701. There is a chance. The most recent low-power FM window the FCC opened recently also closed, but there's some applications that were out there, and there's going to be little stations that are looking for programming. An organization isn't allowed to own more than one low-power FM station, but low-power FMs can share programming. So I really think the next opportunity for community-driven, public interest radio, progressive, whether it's big P or small P, is going to be communities coming together and little stations partnering to get programs like yours heard by more people, and then partner that with internet stuff. And I think maybe if we're lucky and if we work hard, maybe it's the second golden age of radio.
Yeah, I think so. I think that there's a tremendous potential here, a tremendous opportunity. I didn't realize that the FCC had stopped issuing low-power FM licenses. What happened?
Not stop forever, but what they do now, and I'm new to a bunch of this stuff.
Did NPR right? get them to stop? Was that the...
what they do now is a lot of applications that the FCC accepts, they do it on a schedule, right? So they'll allow for a month-long period, like apparently maybe in 6 months they'll allow for translator license applications. And so if you have a native license, you want a translator, you know, they'll give you a 30-day period to go to go apply.
Okay, so for people who don't know what you're talking about, a native license would be this is the base station, but it only serves, you know, a 300 block square area, and you want to serve the rest of the city, so you put up a second transmitter over in the other side of town, and that's called the translator. It's really like a second transmitter.
Exactly. There are at least two potential arguments for why they're doing things with these windows. One possible reason is just sort of administrative capability, right? So they have kind of, okay, this is the
so staff can deal with it.
We dance. The other argument is it sure as heck is better for folks who have Washington D.C. FCC lawyers who are really up to speed on this stuff and can really be ready, right? So that's why it's important. I really appreciate your partnership, because we got to let more people know what's going on.
Yeah. So tell us about X-Ray, KXRY, or xray.fm.
There are people right this very moment, Todd, on X-Ray FM listening to the Tom Hartman program.
With Jefferson Smith.
What we have is a combination of talk and music, some of the leading music curators in our town, people who run local clubs, who started local music labels that are internationally successful, got together with some of the finest working DJs and musicians in our town. And I really do think, inspired by stations like KXP and WFMU and KCRW, that really kind of punch above their weight in taste-making in the music scene. And then some of folks like me in the public affairs arena that after Clear Channel killed KPOJ, right? When you were there, who helped launch our Air America affiliate in Portland, and then they took that off just after the Obama election in 2012. You and Carl Wolfson were the leading voices in our town, took both of them off the air. A lot of us were motivated by that. Anyway, the music folks and some of the public affairs folks joined forces and said, listen, we can build a radio station. We got it started. We put the antenna in the ground, broadcasting a signal. We're already having conversations with others to expand that signal, partner with some other organizations. I think we'll have something to announce in the next month or two on that front. So we got it started.
Plus you're on the internet also. So people, you know, all over the world, but also all over Portland and the areas where your smaller signal may not reach, they can just tune you in on their computer.
In fact, many of the people even within the terrestrial broadcast area will prefer to listen to it on their iPhone, will prefer to listen to it on their laptop.
Right.
There's something neat about having even a modest terrestrial signal. But yes, in Singapore, in Gresham, in West Portland, check out xray.fm. And you mentioned the Kickstarter. I want to say thanks to the people who backed it. But now we need to start gathering members to make this sustainable. You can check it out on xray.fm. But that Kickstarter, as far as we can tell, was the most successful radio station Kickstarter in history. Now, history on Kickstarter isn't that long, but we're still pretty proud of it. And what I think it reflects is the demand for media that reflects the values of our communities, that reflects the needs of the public interest, and maybe not quite as much consolidation as we've been facing over the last 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, local radio. I'm all about it. Even though I do a national show, I've had stations move me or just take less than all 3 hours or whatever over the years in order to put where they were running 24/7 national programming, and they say we're going to put a couple of local hours on and we're going to pull one of yours. I'm like, fine, good, do it. It's like local programming is really, really important. And it's so cool that a community basically got together and said, okay, our local progressive station went dark. We're going to create one, which is what you guys did.
Yeah.
And
and you've been a wonderful friend to the station and to local radio. You've been really flexible with us, and I really hugely appreciate that, Tom.
Well, I totally support what you're doing, and I want it to be successful, not just because I love being back on the air in Portland again, but I think that you are creating a model, and you're the genius at doing this stuff. Yeah, I mean, you started the bus project. You know how to make things happen. Create a model that other people can replicate. You are the training ground. Jefferson Smith, xray.fm is the website. Thank you, Jefferson.
Thanks, Tom. Have a great day.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters: Identity Guard, Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And, you know, when we have, when we notice that among our children we have a problem of drug abuse, we build drug abuse curriculum into our schools, and measurably, repeatedly, in community after community across the United States, drug abuse goes down. When we notice that we have a problem of kids using tobacco and getting addicted to it, it's really dangerous stuff when you're addicted to it as a child. It's much harder as an adult to quit. It actually alters brain chemistry. We build it into curriculum, and the childhood use of drugs goes down. When we notice that we're having explosions of sexually transmitted diseases, HIV, these kind of things, and pregnancy, teenage pregnancy, unwanted pregnancies among our children, we build sex ed into our schools, and we find in state after state that in those states where we do it, that the diseases go down and the pregnancy rate goes down. And in fact, right now, because of widespread sex ed in most states, the national teen rate of unintended pregnancies, births, and abortions have dropped to an all-time record low. But not in Louisiana. In Louisiana, it's against the law to teach sex ed to kids in elementary school. And beyond elementary school, after sixth grade, you can choose to teach sex ed, but you have to emphasize abstinence, and there are no standard curriculum requirements. Bruno Behrendt is with us. He's Senior Fellow for Education Policy with the Heartland Institute. Heartland.org is the website. Bruno, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me on, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm well. So you support Bobby Jindal in saying, no, we're not going to teach our kids what syphilis is.
Well, I wouldn't. Yeah, that's an interesting way to put it. I don't know that that is exactly what Jindal's position is.
It is.
Nor do I necessarily support that you don't teach children what syphilis is. Basically, my position on this is that, and I think this is pretty much would be the position of many conservative governors or conservatives like Jindal, would be that this is an issue that should be entirely elective, up to the parents. And even if parents make some mistakes, even if parents are not some parents are less informed or less knowledgeable than other parents, this is not the kind of thing that you just mandate or force, because this is the kind of thing that parents should have control over.
Okay, let me understand this. I'm assuming that you think that basic hygiene should be taught, the understanding that if you wash your hands, you don't get sick, if you brush your teeth, you don't get cavities, that kind of stuff.
I don't think that's very controversial.
Okay. Yeah, it's science, and it has to do with our bodies, Basic hygiene. So what's wrong with teaching the children, young people, that there is, that people can transmit diseases to each other by having sex or by sexual contact, and that, you probably should think twice about this, and here's what you need to know about it, and here's what the diseases are, and here's what the consequences are.
Well, clearly in today's day and age, where people are getting all kinds of sexual imagery from all across the spectrum, socially and everything, I mean, you can't walk by a Super Bowl TV show, a football game, and not get bombarded with this kind of stuff. I think it does make sense that the children know what about the imagery that they're seeing. But again, it comes back to, is this something that you put into every school? And if you do put it into every school, do you allow parents to opt out, or do you allow parents to have a say in it? And the reason for that is that it's all nice and good to compare this to washing hands and to whether or not to hit yourself on the thumb with a hammer or something like that.
Or brush your teeth.
Sex education is involving
It involves sex.
It involves sex, and there are various cultural and religious and moral reasons people may want to have a little bit more of a say in that as to whether or not somebody should know 1 + 1 = 2.
I'm not suggesting the teachers should be saying, hey, here's what an orgy is, and here's how much fun they are. I'm suggesting that basic, you know, the mechanics of sex, I mean, what are you afraid of? Why would you not want, and I'm, you know, talking age appropriate, although I think that age probably has declined over the last decade or two, because I doubt that there's a 10-year-old boy in America now who hasn't seen porn on the internet. And
isn't that a wonderful situation?
Well, that's the situation that we're dealing with. And so if they're seeing porn on the internet and they're recreating it, that might account for the reason why Louisiana right now is having an explosion among second stage syphilis, gonorrhea, and HIV among 12-year-olds.
Well, clearly, you know, in terms of the specific statistics of one state or another state, in a situation like that where you have the statistics simply, and again, you're familiar with the specifics of this, and I didn't get a chance to see the specific articles. I was looking for preparing for the show here. I was looking at sex education science and various different ways that people are teaching this.
Well, you should really look at the stats from state to state, because in those states where they teach comprehensive sex education in elementary school, you have lower rates of abortions, you have lower rates of unwanted pregnancies, you have lower rates of gonorrhea, you have lower rates of syphilis, and you have lower rates of HIV/AIDS. That seems like a desirable outcome, even if some people may say, you know, I feel a little uncomfortable with using the word erection around a 12-year-old.
Here's a couple of different things having to do with the statistics, and this goes back to a lot of the education statistics that people throw around. There are reasons why certain things are the way they are in Massachusetts, other than the way they are in Louisiana, that go far beyond whether or not it's a specific curriculum or something is or isn't taught in a specific school. The people who defend the public education system monopoly love to point out that places like New York and Massachusetts or the Northeast or Illinois have these different figures, and they love to aggregate figures when it serves to aggregate them, and then when it serves to disaggregate them, they like to disaggregate.
But I'm not talking about the quality of their science lab, which reflects the revenue base of their local income tax, you know, property tax.
What I'm trying to make.
I'm talking about the fact that Louisiana has forbidden by law any education that has to do with sex or sexually transmitted diseases before basically the age of 12 or 13, sixth grade. And after that, they forbid by law the teaching of any kind of education that doesn't primarily emphasize abstinence, which means that ultimately what happens is in junior high schools and high schools, the sex ed course is basically the teacher saying, okay, sex, don't do it. Now, we've checked that off. Now let's talk about math. And you've got, as a consequence of this, in Louisiana, and not just Louisiana, but Louisiana is the low-hanging fruit. It's the worst state in the country. And you have a problem with the kids. Surprise, surprise.
Look, from the standpoint of Louisiana, if you were trying to get somebody on the air to say that what Louisiana does is the right thing and the statistics be damned, this is what they should be doing, I don't think that's a fair characterization of my position. I can't speak for Governor Jindal or the House of Representatives and the Senate that passed that legislation. I think what you're seeing in Louisiana, and I think there's a reasonable middle ground of saying, okay, what is the appropriate sex education? What is
they won't even allow that conversation because there is no appropriate sex education in Louisiana.
So the question would be
in elementary schools.
Would be who, you know, what do it? So this would be an interesting part of the study I'd like to see. Leaving aside the large aggregated statistics, which let's put it this way, there may be some correlation and there may be some causation between what Louisiana's laws are and the numbers. I not having read specific science or any other specific things on that, I would concede that there is probably some level of causation and or correlation with their laws, which is probably the most stringent in the country, and their poor results that they're having. The question becomes whether you just want to say, okay, we're going to change that law, here's the state-based curriculum, every child has to go, and the parents don't have any say in whether or not the child does that or not. That's the
Bruno, I'm leaving you with the last word. Bruno Behrend, hang on just a second, Bruno.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Senior Fellow for Education Policy at the Heartland Institute, heartland.org. Thank you, Bruno.
Thank you very much.
Good talking. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And yeah, this is fascinating. Let me just fill this story in a little bit, because I kind of rushed through it as I was setting it up. Louisiana State Representative Patricia Smith, and she's a state representative. She's a member of the House of Representatives in the legislature of the state of Louisiana, wants mandatory sex education in the public schools. And she has introduced a piece of legislation, House Bill 369, that amends the current law and requires every public school to provide age-appropriate sex ed. Now, you know, what is the question is, what is age appropriate? But I think that there's a broad consensus on this among educators across the United States. We have curriculum. You have, textbook publishers who have come up with curriculum. It's the ages at which different things that have to do with sex can be discussed, and the way that you do them is not loosey-goosey stuff anymore. It's solid science. I mean, I'm an old fart. I remember sex ed in seventh or eighth grade was the first time we had any sex ed. And it was basically the gym teacher getting all the boys together and telling us that if you masturbate too frequently, you will go blind. And I'm not making that up. He actually told us that. And then he had, lessons for how to pee in public. I mean, it was just weird. It was just weird. And there was no real discussion about sex or sex education. I mean, it was just this, the poor guy, right? I mean, he probably wasn't taught how to be a sex ed teacher. He was just the gym teacher for, Walter French Junior High School. And boom, good luck, Charlie. He seemed terribly embarrassed. It was one of those 1 hour, okay, we did that this year things, special. The girls were in a different area, in a different gym with the female gym teacher. But anyhow, Louisiana doesn't mandate sex ed. It actually forbids schools, as Tara Culp-Ressler points out over at Think Progress. Faced with the rising STD rates, which is the headline, Louisiana lawmakers' lack of sex ed is really a form of child abuse. And this lawmaker comes out and says, the current lack of adequate standards is a form of child abuse. You've got kids who are dooming themselves to a very difficult life and probably a very painful death as a result of acquiring HIV/AIDS, particularly difficult for people in Louisiana where the state is not accepting Medicare money. There is no health care available outside of the emergency room for poor people in the state, and it has one of the highest proportions of poor people in the country. So Bobby Jindal not only is preventing these kids from learning about these diseases, but then when they get the diseases, he will not provide them or their families with health care. He won't take the Medicaid money from the federal government to expand Medicaid in Louisiana. So, I mean, basically it's like a variation on Alan Grayson's, Republican health care strategy. Don't get sick. If you do get sick, die quickly. And it's like, don't get AIDS, don't get syphilis, but if you do, die quickly, which you will do without treatment. So Bobby Jindal is helping them to die quickly by not providing Medicaid expansion. And he's helping them to get infected in the first place by not even telling them about what these diseases are, where they come from, or all the things associated with it. So anyhow, we'll be back with your thoughts and your calls on this, tipping, anything else you want to get into right after this break. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and Louisiana State Representative Patricia Smith calling for mandatory sex ed in the state's public schools because the state of Louisiana is facing an explosion of sexually transmitted diseases, and because Bobby Jindal will not take Medicaid expansion dollars. I mean, as I said earlier, this is a variation on Alan Grayson's, here's the Republican health care plan. Don't get sick. If you do get sick, die quickly. Well, don't get AIDS, 12-year-old kid. But if you do get AIDS because you were engaged, because you were imitating that porn you saw on the internet with your friend, and nobody told you that there were dangers associated with that that could be avoided, if you do get AIDS, die quickly. Because Bobby Jindal is not going to let you have Medicaid because your family's poor. Sorry. This is truly bizarre. It's truly bizarre. Okay, we've talked about that. We've talked about how the whole retirement scam, basically Americans' retirements have been stolen from them by the banksters. It's all Reaganomics, and they're not giving it back. We've talked about how basic science is not being funded appropriately in this country as a consequence of Reaganomics. We've talked about, should we have tipping in this country, or should we be following the more European model of paying waitstaff well and maybe allowing tips for extraordinary service? So we got a lot of people who want to weigh in on both topics. Linda in Seattle. Hey, Linda, you taught sex ed?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I've been a teacher and taught nutrition and health and human fertility in middle schools and a private school system.
Mm-hmm.
And the statistics now, as when I was in high school in the 60s, are pretty much the same with regard to parents explaining sexuality to their children. They're not any better at it than they were when I was in high school.
Right.
And the thing about that people don't understand is that the only social system in the human body is the reproductive system. And so it's, I believe, very appropriate for schools to teach human fertility, age-appropriate human fertility, starting even in third grade when you talk about the birds and the bees and then progress to...
In other words, first discuss it in the context of animals. You still there, Linda? Oh, we lost Linda. First discuss it in the context of animals. Actually, you know, there's also the alimentary canal, which is, you know, starts with the mouth. You could start at a younger age by talking about kissing, because there are sexually transmitted diseases that can be transmitted by kissing. And in kissing, you can exchange bodily fluids. So that would be a possibility. Let's see if we lost all our calls or just Linda. Gary in Mount Hermon, Louisiana. Are you there, Gary? Gary's not there. Is Carlos there in Chicago? Carlos is not there. Jane in Seattle? No Jane. Robert in Bensonville, Illinois? Oh, our internet is down. Okay, Kaflui. And Steve in Malibu, California? No, no Steve. Okay. So, anyhow, the wonders of having Comcast as your telephone provider. I just have to say, you know, this company that wants to, like, take over the Internet, they want to rule the world. Well, if you're trying to call into our program and it ain't working, you can thank Comcast. And here we are in the capital city. This is not the rant that I planned, but it seems like an appropriate one. Here we are in the capital city of the United States. And because, to some extent, Because the conservatives in Congress have the final say in how money is spent and appropriated here in Washington, D.C., we have some of the worst infrastructure in the country. I mean, we are in an office building which is shared by a number of members of Congress. We have, I know of five senators who are in this building. They come here to raise money. And this office building has one provider for internet service, one provider for telephone. That's it. And it's Comcast, and it sucks. As you can tell right now, like I said, if you try to call us, it ain't going to work. At least until they come back up again. It's been up and down and up and down for 2 weeks, this week and last week. 3 weeks, Shane says. 3 weeks this has been going on. And this is the company that controls, what, a quarter of the Internet service in the country, local ISPs and cable C, and now they want to get even bigger? You look at countries like South Korea. Louise and I had breakfast Saturday morning with a friend of ours, John. I don't know if he wants his last name out there, but John's from Denver, and he had been in South Korea just a few weeks ago or a few months ago with a group of people that I'm affiliated with. And I didn't go, but they went to South Korea to look at their Internet infrastructure. And it was really quite extraordinary because in South Korea, the Internet infrastructure is really robust. I mean, for $25-$30 a month, you get 100 MIP download, 50-60 MIP upload. You get this incredibly fast, blazing fast fiber optic Internet. Why? Because the government said having fiber in everybody's house, having high quality, high-speed Internet is what's going to make us competitive in the 21st century. It's what's going to enable us to clean America's clock, and they are doing it. And since we started the Korea Free Trade Agreement 2 years ago, our debt with Korea has exploded because they're selling a whole lot more stuff to us than we're selling to them because we don't make stuff here anymore. Why? Because what manufacturing company would want to start a factory in a place where you can't even get reliable Internet service? It's part of the infrastructure. It's part of the commons. And yet we, in our infinite wisdom, have given it entirely over to private for-profit corporations, even though it's going through the public rights of way, even though it's going through the public commons, even though, I mean, there's a certain amount of Fifth Amendment taking involved with this. And yet still we say, oh, you can externalize the costs, internalize the profits, and screw your customers, and we're not going to say a word about it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Yeah, or try it again in 5 minutes. Maybe Comcast will give us back our service. Maybe not. The bad and the very, very estiferously ugly, brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, ecowine.com. The good, Warner, New Hampshire. Last week, the small New Hampshire town joined 29 other municipalities across the state in calling for a constitutional amendment to overturn the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United decision. In a town meeting on Tuesday, it adopted a resolution created by the organization Move to Amend, stating that only human beings have constitutional rights and that money is not speech. Well done, Warner. Let's hope Washington lawmakers are listening. The bad. Rupert Murdoch. Earlier this morning, the News Corp chairman sent out a tweet condemning Guinness for pulling out of New York City's St. Patrick's Day parade over its exclusion of gay and lesbian groups. He said, "Where will this end? Guinness pulls out of religious parade, bullied by gay orgs who try to take it over. Hope all Irish boycott the stuff." What a bizarre understanding of bullying. I think it's safe to say that Rupert Murdoch does not deserve a pint of Guinness this St. Patrick's Day. And the very, very ugly Austin Roos. During a recent guest appearance on the American Family Association's Sandy Rios show, the right-wing pundit blasted liberal college professors who he said should be shot. Seriously, take a listen.
The toxic stew of the modern university is gender studies. It's sex week. They all have sex week and teaching people how to be sex positive and overcoming the patriarchy. My daughters go to a little private religious school. I do hope that they go to a Christian college or university, and to keep them so far away from the hard left human-hating people that run modern universities, who should all be taken out and shot.
Whether Roos agrees with women and gender studies or not is beside the point. The fact that anyone would call for the execution of somebody because they disagree with them? Well, that's not just very, very ugly. That also indicates a really seriously troubled mind. That's pretty amazing. That is seriously amazing. Outside political groups are spending record amounts of money to deny poor people health care. By the way, I was going off on Bobby Jindal earlier. The number of people in Louisiana who will not get health care is 400,000 because Bobby Jindal won't take money for the expansion of Medicaid in Louisiana. Bizarre. Edward in Capistrano Beach, California. Hey, is it working now? Maybe not.
How are you doing? Can you hear me?
Ah, Edward, you're there.
Yes, I'm here. I didn't have to wait that long either.
Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to talk just real quick about the sex education and the guilt and the shame that this society puts upon us under our religious zeal. My best friend from Sweden, I met when I was in fifth grade. He was an exchange student. Our families became intertwined. And their sex education was real sex education.
Right.
If you know what I'm saying. So it was the proper use of a condom.
Right. I understand.
It wasn't about shame or guilt for having these human emotions. They actually even taught them the proper techniques to pleasure a partner. Wow. Now, if you were to bring that up in the United States, you'd get this big war about encouraging children to go out and have sex. Well, they're going to go out and have it anyway.
Right. And they're going to...
I don't know if I'm making any sense.
No, you are. And they're going to do it poorly, and they're going to do it dangerously, and they're going to do it in ways that cause people to die and that ruin relationships. And I agree with you. I think that this... There's fundamental science here, you know. There are obviously ages at which it's appropriate to discuss it, and ages at which it's a very confusing thing. You know, as long as kids are of the opinion that, you know, the opposite sex is ooh cooties, that's not when you're going to be talking to them about those kind of things. Obviously, although you would be educating them about biology and how biology works, whether it's human biology or any kind of mammalian biology. It's just straightforward stuff. Edward, thanks for the call and thanks for the comment. Steve in Malibu, California, you wanted to get into the tail end of the tipping conversation here, Steve.
Hey, good afternoon, Tom. How are you?
I am well. What's up?
Hey, just a little anecdote. You were talking about how bad the internet is.
Mm-hmm.
You're struggling with Comcast. You'll appreciate this. I do some business over at UCLA, and I was over there, and I said, we'll send this to you by bring your over the internet. And they said, well, our internet's really slow here. I said, really? Your internet is slow here? Did you know the internet was invented here?
I was going to say, they helped invent the that's amazing.
They were complaining about how slow the rest of the world has fast internet. And, you know, we're here in Southern California where it was invented. We have terrible nightmare.
Yeah, yeah. And same here.
But anyway, I was going to tell you, I owned a restaurant for 17 years, and it was a real struggle because in California, they had, in Jerry Brown Part 1, he had eliminated what was called tip credit. This is back a few years ago. So that meant that the waitresses and waiters were paid full minimum wage, which I think is great. Problem is that we couldn't raise our prices enough to adjust that, so our waitresses were making pretty good money. And it reached the point where I'd be standing there bussing their tables for them while they were chatting with their customers because I couldn't afford to have enough people on the floor.
So why not just do what this restaurant in California did, where they just add a minimum mandatory 18% to every check, and you know that covers your wait staff cost.
Well, I mean, but $1 an hour at rate.
Steve, I think it's your phone going in and out right now. Steve, I'm sorry, you're fading in and out, and I don't think it's Comcast on our end. I think you must be calling on a cell phone. We'll find out. Yeah, Mike in St. Clair Shores, Michigan, are you there, Mike?
Yeah, that's me.
Okay, so it was Steve's phone.
Yeah. You're great, and I hope everyone gets better.
Thank you. Amen. And may Comcast do well, too. Sex ed, you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, I don't think it's 12-year-olds infecting 12-year-olds, other 12-year-olds with viruses. I'm pretty sure it must be older people taking advantage of naive kids with no instruction about
14 and 16-year-olds infecting 12-year-olds.
Or even older, you know?
Yeah.
That's what I think. I think it's if you don't give them the information, they don't have the information to protect themselves.
Right.
They don't.
And one of the things they don't have the information to protect themselves from is predators.
Yes, exactly. Also, I wanted to mention about tipping. I was in New Zealand. You're not allowed to tip in New Zealand. They pay their wait staff excellent wage.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't tip at all in New Zealand. That was an interesting
thing. It's like banned. You just can't do it.
Right. It is an insult.
It would be like trying to slip the guy at the Saks Fifth Avenue a $10 bill. Actually, over at Saks, if they're modifying your pants, they do take tips. But yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And last week when someone called about liberal or progressive,
mm-hmm.
Check out Netflix with West Wing. They have the episode where Jimmy Smith's does the thing with Alan Alda, and it's so great how he says, I would take the liberal, you throw it at my feet like it's something dirty, I would gladly pin it to my chest.
Yeah, yeah. Though there were some good episodes there back in the day. Mike, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for your comments. Robert in Bensonville, Illinois, listen to WCPT. Hey, Robert.
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Good. Tipping?
Good. Yeah, I just want to... Me and my girlfriend both work in the industry of tipping, servers. Bartender is her occupation. But I was at, Denny's for 5 years, and they franchised Denny's to another company, a smaller franchisee. And they took away our vacation hours, our, you know, basically anything holiday. There was nothing extra left over when they sold us out. And then after about 2 years of, you know, working for that same company, same franchisee that was bought, same store from Denny's, I was told at the end of my tour that I wanted to go get a second job to go look for one. That was fine when I went to go get one and gave them my schedule. They scheduled me, not even giving me the fact that I went to go get a second job, but when I told a regional manager what was going on with my scheduling, she said, well, if you want to go, you want to go get another job, be my guest, because you signed paperwork 2 years ago that you were available, and that's what you're hired for. So basically it was get fired and get rehired to get a new schedule. It was you signed on the dotted line and you're stuck here.
You mean they were giving you a variable schedule so that you couldn't assure a second employer of your availability at a particular time?
At a particular time, yes.
Right. This is a really low-down, sneaky trick where these employers, they keep you below 30 hours a week so that they don't have to pay benefits and you're not really full-time employee, and they slip under a whole bunch of different, you know, laws that regulate the workplace. And then they say, oh, by the way, those 30 hours, on Monday you've got to work 8 to 4. On Tuesday you've got to work 3 to 9. On Wednesday, you know, and like that. And then they change it every week or every 2 weeks or every 3 weeks, which days, what times, so that you can't get a second job, so that they don't have to worry about having an employee who's tired. But they have an employee who's impoverished. It's bizarre. It's absolutely bizarre. Robert, thanks for the call. Linda in Seattle, you got... Oh, Linda, hold on. I missed a time cue. Hold on just a second. Hopefully, the Comcast gods will keep us with you, and we'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Talk media for the rest of us. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
By the way, the Koch brothers are continuing to run these anti-Obamacare ads, and I don't get it. California had set a goal of 600,000 people. They've signed up over 1 million. And welcome back. Linda in Seattle. Shall we try that again?
Yes.
Hey, Linda.
Tom. I've had the opportunity to teach middle school health and nutrition and human sexuality in private schools for 20 years.
Right.
The statistics now about parents teaching their children about sexuality are the same as they were 40 years ago, so parents aren't doing a good job.
Right.
And public schools in many states who offer sex education allow parents to opt out if they want. And so that's something that would meet many people that object to it.
I would think that a lot of parents would feel relieved if the school is teaching sex education.
Yeah, it's true, especially when they know what you're teaching them,
right?
Which is the way I did it. I had parent evening and explained to them what exactly I was giving their children. Also, most people don't think about the systems of the body in the context of the reproductive system being the only social system in the body.
Right.
So when you take that into context, we're working not only on the physical level, but the emotional, the psychosocial level and that's the way I taught this curriculum, so that you address all these questions that puberty and adolescence bring up in the kids.
Well, it's interesting. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, yeah, I was reading Thomas Jefferson a while ago, and he would refer to social intercourse. And I mean, you know, for hundreds of years, we use the word intercourse to describe interrelations between people that had nothing to do with sex, and as well as sexual intercourse. But the point was that intercourse meant interaction, intercourse, right? And
right.
And now it's become a dirty word, and which just seems bizarre to me.
Well, and you can, and also we know that all our teens are exposed to so much media and sexuality. Wouldn't it be nice if they had another picture,
yes,
of what healthy sexuality is?
Right.
So that's all I had to offer.
What is your sense of the, or tell me if I'm wrong on this. When I was 8, 9 years old and curious about this stuff, the stuff that I had access to was my cousin's dad's collection of Playboy magazines, which,
uh-huh,
you know, taught me something, but not a great deal. But I know that every boy that I knew who was 8 or 9 or 10 years old, or maybe 11, whatever, it would depend on the, you know, kid and the age, had seen Playboy magazine. I mean, it was like a rite of passage. It was something that every kid did. Is that not the case today with every 10, 11, 12, 13-year-old boy finding porn on the internet? And probably, I'm assuming girls too. And if so, what is that doing to our kids?
Right. Well, they're getting a media, cultural, societal look at what sex is. They see that on television. They see it on the internet. They see it everywhere.
Right.
If you ask me, in the old days when the 10, 12, 13-year-olds got a hold of a Playboy magazine, at least they were looking at something that was healthy and normal.
Right. Now they're looking at S&M or whatever. Yeah. Linda, thank you very much for the call. Thanks for the informed perspective and for being a great teacher. I appreciate it. 10 minutes before the hour, Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service up next. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. You give a gift of a goat to a returning slave in South Sudan. Victoria Jones on the line with us. And, Victoria, you're not coming in by Skype today.
No, I'm not. We were hoping that Zach Badoff, who's in Crimea, was going to be able to be with you. But I think technical difficulties have meant that he couldn't get through.
Well, we've been having technical difficulties on our end. Comcast has, we've been up and down and up and down. And I was wondering if you were having the same problem with a lousy Comcast service in the city.
No, I'm the backup, so I was hoping that it would be Zach.
I see. So that's why you're not coming
to
Westgate.
I'm the number two.
Okay. All right, number two. What's going on today?
President of Russia, Vladimir Putin, has signed a decree recognizing Crimea as a sovereign and independent state. Presidential sources say this decree enters into force on the day on which it is signed. They add the move follows Sunday's referendum in Crimea, in which officials said 97% of voters backed breaking away from Ukraine and joining Russia. The U.S. and EU earlier imposed sanctions on a number of officials from Russia and Ukraine over the vote, including former Ukrainian President Yanukovych. And President Obama also threatened further possible sanctions, depending on what was going to happen, whether Russia escalated or de-escalated the situation in Ukraine. He also stressed there was a path to solve the crisis diplomatically.
My question is still Ron Paul's question. What's our interest there? Why do we care?
Well, I think this is an interesting question, and I think that this...
It's not even a Rwanda situation or a Bosnia situation. I mean, it's not like people are being bombed or the rape camps are being set up. It's just, why do we care?
Well, and I think there's polling, interesting polling out from a CNN poll that would sort of support you indirectly, that President Obama's policy of sanctions is supported, 6 in 10. But when you look at doing more things like economic assistance to Ukraine's government, 52% oppose it. When you look at sending weapons to Ukraine's government, 76% oppose that. U.S. airstrikes, 82% oppose that. And ground troops, 88% of Americans oppose that.
Yeah. I mean, it's at least in Iraq, we had Dick Cheney telling us, you know, they're sitting on 10% of the world's oil. Very, very easy to get oil. You know, it's second only to Saudi Arabia. At least we understood that there was something in it for us. If we did it right, we'd be able to steal their oil. But we got nothing in Ukraine, to the best of my knowledge.
It's one of those things where the United States is saying that we will not accept in the 21st century that one country can walk into another country and plant a flag.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's not. If it was that simple,
stand-up routine.
If it was that simple, I would agree. But you know, you've got a majority of ethnic Russians living in Crimea, and they've had military bases there in Russia for years, and this is one of those gray areas. And I just, you know, personally, I'm just like, this is not my fight. Anyway, back to you.
The White House said today that administration officials are recalibrating. Amid growing opposition to President Obama's nomination for Surgeon General from Senate Democrats and criticism from the NRA, White House Press Secretary Jay Carney said, "We are recalibrating and assessing our strategy moving forward with the nomination." There were as many as this is after the filibuster was got rid of, so they only need 51. As many as 10 Senate Democrats have signaled that they'd oppose the nomination of Dr. Vivek Murthy, who's been targeted by the NRA after voicing support for bans of certain types of firearms and ammunition purchases. He's also called for mandatory gun safety programs and the removal of restrictions on anti-gun advocacy research. Now, the White House didn't say what form this shift in strategy would take, but did say that they've not abandoned Murthy's nomination.
Huh. I just give him time. I mean, this is a testimonial to the incredible damage that Citizens United has done to this country, that an oligarch or an oligarchic institution, the NRA, can be the dog, the tail that wags the dog of the White House and Congress. It's crazy. And this doctor is calling for totally reasonable things in the context of public health. We're not allowed to have that conversation in this country?
Well, and it is fascinating that it is so, that it is written in that there are restrictions on anti-gun advocacy research, that there are restrictions on what you can research.
Oh, hey, it goes worse than that. Did you know that there is a law that says that any federal employee who compiles statistics on gun deaths in the United States goes to prison?
Wow.
I mean, it's nuts, the bizarre laws that the NRA has gotten passed. Anyhow, what else is going on?
President Obama said today that he'd pursue the elusive goal of a comprehensive peace agreement between Israel and Palestinians during a meeting with Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas at the White House. He said, Obama did, "It's very hard. It's very challenging. We're going to have to take some tough political decisions and risks if we're able to move it forward. And my hope is that we can continue to see progress in the coming days and weeks." Well, he doesn't have long, because it's just weeks until the U.S. deadline to complete negotiations on a framework deal. And during a visit with Obama a couple of weeks ago, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu declared it was about time for the Palestinian people to recognize a state for the Jewish people, but Mahmoud Abbas has flatly refused to do so. So things aren't really moving forward. Abbas, seated next to the president, said the leaders don't have any time to waste. Time is not on our side. especially given the very difficult situation that the Middle East is experiencing and the entire region is facing. And we hope that we would be able to seize this opportunity to achieve a lasting peace, he said.
I hope so. Do you think there's a chance?
No.
No. Okay.
Not at this time.
I suspect you're right, but I still hope so. And Victoria, you're always number one on my book. You are the absolute best reporter that the show has ever had on. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Great talking. We'll be back with more of our program. In fact, Bryce Covert is going to come by. He's going to talk about tipping and the living wage. This should be interesting. Let's see where we go with this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, this is fascinating. Over at the Democratic Underground, they put together their graphic of the day. This is Wing Nuts of the Week, Racism Edition. And conservative culture critic James... Say what? Oh, we have Bryce. Oh, cool. I will get back to this in just a moment. But right now, Bryce Covert is with us. She's a reporter with the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress. Hey, Bryce.
Hi, how you doing?
I am well. Am I pronouncing your last name right?
Covert, like covert op.
Aha, perfect. Okay, you wrote a great piece about how the government botched the Wall Street crisis. I would like to ask you about that, and also Mississippi drug testing welfare recipients. But the one that was at the top of the list was banning tipping and paying a living wage. Is it okay if we talk about all these things?
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. I brought this up at the first hour of the show about the public option, this new brew pub here in D.C. that's going to just pay $15 an hour and benefits rather than tips. And I'm getting all these calls from people who are tipped workers saying, "Hey, wait a minute, I was making a pretty good living here." I'm wondering, you know, and when you were researching this, what did you learn about tip workers?
Well, I think the first thing to remember about tip workers in this country is that they have a much lower minimum wage than every other worker. The tipped minimum wage is $2.13, which should probably sound pretty low because the minimum wage for everyone else is $7.25 an hour. And now restaurant owners are supposed to make up the difference if tips don't bring their hourly wages up to $7.25 an hour,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of them don't. So a lot of people who are working in the restaurant industry are living off really low wages. The tips aren't making it up, and that's why we see a poverty rate among them that is nearly triple that of everyone else. I understand that for some people, the tips can feel really lucrative, and I think in certain establishments that's probably true, but for by and large, that doesn't tend to help people make a really stable living. And it also comes with a lot of other unsavory side effects. The research on tipping really shows that people think that what they're doing is rewarding good service, but that's really not what ends up happening. Tips really don't vary very much by service. A lot of people say they're not even paying 20%, which is basically the the standard we all think of when we tip. 11% of people say they leave nothing at all. So it's a system that's not really rewarding people for better service. What they end up rewarding people for are things like they're a woman, or a woman who's attractive will get even more of a tip. White servers make more money than black servers. So there's a lot of sort of unconscious things that are going on that are expressed in tipping that we don't really like, and the things we think that we like to express, like appreciation for good service, aren't actually what's coming through.
Now, I mentioned I lived in, Louise and I and our kids lived in Germany for a year back many years ago. But at that time, and I'm assuming it's still the case, German companies pay their wait staff well enough that most Germans don't tip, or when they do tip, they basically just round out the change. You know, if your meal came to $25.30 and you put down $26 and they bring you back 70 cents, you leave the coinage on the table. And you know, it might amount to $1 or $2 because they've got larger coins than we do. But occasionally you would leave a tip if you got what you thought was really extraordinary service. But I told the story of I left a 20% tip once when I, in the early days when we had moved there, and the waiter brought it back to me. He was insulted. He felt that I was ridiculing him. And is that a system? I mean, that's typical all across Europe and in many other parts of the world. Is that a system that we should consider adopting in the United States?
Right. Yeah, I think that is a much more humane system. What these restaurants are doing in the U.S. that are experimenting with them is that they are getting rid of tips, and instead they're just paying their workers a living wage and giving them good benefits, which I think is a better trade-off. The public option, which is a bar in D.C. that's opening and will be doing this, is going to pay at least $15 an hour, hopefully maybe a little bit more for those who have a little bit more experience. I pointed out in my piece, it's one of the first things restaurants or bars that I've seen to do this that doesn't cater to a high-end clientele, so I think that's really interesting. But some other restaurants have done the same thing more on the high-end scale, and I think they make a pretty good deal for their workers. At a sushi restaurant in New York, they get vacation days, paid sick leave, health insurance, as well as decent pay, which is a lot more than what most restaurant workers can say they get. And then in a West Coast place called Linkery, they ban tipping, and the founder also really loves it because he says that his service improved, his revenue went up, more people wanted to work there. He found that the environment that it creates is one of teamwork instead of sort of competing against each other for tips. And the service improves because, like I said, tips don't really vary on service. So you're not really sending a message. So it's easier for a manager to be the one talking about service than waiters feeling like they're trying to figure out what it is that they're getting in feedback from the people that they're serving. Mm. And all of that leads, that better atmosphere has led him to have higher profits because people want to come eat there.
Wow, that's great. Now, meanwhile, down in Mississippi, I was going off on Bobby Jindal in the last hour. We had a conversation about sex ed in our schools. But at Mississippi next door, we talk about the war on women, but I have not heard the phrase war on the poor used very much. But I don't know how else to describe what Mississippi is doing.
Yeah, Mississippi just passed a bill to drug test some welfare recipients. Basically, what they're going to do is have all people who are applying to temporary assistance for needy families, which is cash assistance, they have to answer a questionnaire that evaluates their likelihood of substance abuse. And then if they are deemed to be at risk, which I think is interesting, I'm not entirely sure how they determine that from a questionnaire, but if they're deemed to be at risk, then they have to take a drug test. And if they test positive, they have to undergo treatment for substance abuse. If they test positive again, they get kicked out for 3 months. And a third positive test kicks them out for a year. And now while you may be saying to yourself, well, you know, they've tested positive for drugs, I think about what that does. That cuts off someone's lifeline when maybe they are struggling with substance abuse.
Right.
How are they supposed to get back on their feet if they don't have a little bit of help to get them through for an entire year? That's a really long period to go.
Is the state providing the funding for the treatment?
I'm not sure where the funding for the treatment comes.
They're not expanding Medicaid, so they're not throwing them into the public health system.
Right. They are funding at least the administrative costs of doing these drug tests through money that comes to them from the government for this program. And what's disturbing about that is that states get a limited pot of money from the government for welfare, and then the states have somewhat wide discretion to decide how they use it. But if they use some of that money to administer drug tests, that means it's not money that's going towards benefits or helping people pay for child care or helping with job training. You know, it's finite. If you steal it from it for one thing, it's taking it from another. And it's not the first state by far to experiment with drug testing, but what we've seen with all the other ones is that it's very costly and you don't get any benefit from it. You know, there's a stereotype for whatever reason that welfare recipients are more likely to be drug users, but time and again we found that's actually not the case, that they have lower rates of substance abuse than the general population. So it's kind of, you're on a wild goose chase for something that's quite expensive.
Yeah, it's a racialized stereotype. I mean, this goes back, I remember Ronald Reagan in 1980 saying, doesn't it get you upset when you're standing in line waiting to buy a hamburger and some young buck, and we all know what he meant when he said that, is standing in front of you waiting to buy T-bone steaks with food stamps. And it's just so wrong. Anyhow, Bryce Covert, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Ronald Reagan's war on poor people continues, it seems. It will be back 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Zach Badorf on the line with us from Ukraine. Hey, Zach.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us again. I should add, Zach is with the Talk Radio News Service, and they're correspondent in that part of the world right now. So what's going on from what you're seeing? First of all, where are you in Ukraine?
I'm in Donetsk, Ukraine, which, as I'm sure you know, is in the eastern part of the country. Yesterday I was in Crimea for the referendum, for the vote itself. And we quickly realized that things were very calm there. The vote did represent the vast majority of the will of the people there, despite a number of people boycotting. So we decided, I and some of my colleagues decided to move up to Donetsk, where things are a little bit more contentious, where there's a little bit more division between the people in terms of support for moving Ukraine towards the EU and as opposed to moving it toward Russia.
Well, you're in Ukraine, not in Crimea any longer, right?
Exactly. Yep.
Okay. So the moving toward the EU, correct me if I'm wrong, involves taking a big loan from the IMF, and that involves cutting back on the social services, cutting back on their equivalent of Social Security. Changing the way that they organize their banks. I mean, there's just this long list. I've got it around here someplace of all the things that will occur to Ukraine if they take this money from the IMF. Is that part of the conversation?
No, not really. People in Ukraine, the ones I've spoken to, are interested in these sort of things, how it will affect them personally. But I think they're not looking so much at these agreements. They're looking at where their interests lie personally. And I think a lot of folks in this part of Ukraine believe that they're much more linked closely to Russia, as well as people I spoke to in Crimea. And so they feel like they have a pretty strong connection with Russia economically, and they don't have a good connection with the folks in Kiev. And as I'm sure you know, there's this perception by a number of people in this part of the country that the people in Kiev who are now in power, this new government after Yanukovych absconded to Russia, this new government they believe is extremist, is led by the Svoboda, the far right. They believe that these guys are anti-Semitic, homophobic, thugs and criminals.
What you know?
Yeah, that's a great question. And a lot of Russian propaganda and media backed by the Kremlin, sometimes you'll see these guys being viewed as the majority, that they are, you know, that this is a big faction.
Right.
And it's true, they do have some control.
Well, they have several members in the cabinet, in the new president's cabinet, and they've got the new president, don't they?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, they definitely have a part in the government, and they make up roughly, from what I understand, about 10% of the opposition vote there. But that being said, at Euromaidan itself, where I spent a week in earlier February, the people there who are actually participating and getting behind the movement are very democratic-minded. They want change in their government, just as the people in Donetsk and Crimea want change. So there is this misperception, I think, on behalf of some people that just buy into propaganda that is being spread in these areas. And in fact, it goes so far as to saying that they don't believe that Russian troops actually are in control of Crimea at this very moment. I mean, I was talking to someone earlier today who just does not buy it at all.
They just dismissed that. Mm-hmm. And President Putin has apparently signed an agreement saying, yeah, okay, we recognize you guys. So Crimea is now part of Russia, or soon will be, I guess.
They're working it through the system at the moment.
Yeah. One of the questions that keeps coming up for me is the Ron Paul question. You know, what's our interest in that region? Why should we care? Do you have any better answer to that than I've not been able to get a good answer anywhere other than, you know, the IMF wants to get involved with this and we should be supportive of them or something like that.
Well, you know, I think it's important to note that we're not really all that involved. I mean, there have been some National Endowment of the Democracy, all those sort of probably IRI and what's that other democratic institution.
The old neocon groups.
They're involved pretty much everywhere, you know, and they get behind civic actions and they get people on social media and all those sort of little things that add up to, you know, what we perceive as democracy. So they're definitely there. But I don't really see our role here being so large. And in fact, I think our role, the EU in particular, is being particularly weak. They have these supposed sanctions, and the U.S., Obama apparently announced some sanctions today against some leaders in Russia who are connected with all this. And I see it as being pretty much ineffective. People here...
Or symbolic.
Donetsk have, or symbolic, sure. Yeah, symbolic. And people here in Donetsk have no interest in the U.S. being involved. And same in Crimea. But if you move to parts of, the Euromaidan folks who are, you know, activists who are fighting for what they see as a more democratic society in Ukraine, they absolutely want more support from the U.S., I just don't think it's there. And really, these sanctions seem very ineffectual because it all comes down to who is going to blink first.
Sure.
You know, is Russia able to withstand these sanctions, or is the EU able to withstand not getting this natural gas, which is incredibly important to them?
Yeah, 30% of their natural gas is coming through Ukraine. I don't think that they're going to say no thank you, at least not during the winter. Zach?
You know, one last thing.
Yeah, go for
it. If it's possible to jump in, one last thing that I wanted to sort of talk about that I don't think we've talked about too much is the Russian presence and the militia presence in Crimea was very intimidating. And I had never been in a situation like that where I felt like these were lawless people who can do whatever they want. And they have beat up foreign and local journalists. It's a really tough situation there. And I think that really had an impact on the vote as well.
That's interesting. Zach Bador, calling live from Ukraine. Thank you, Zach.
Thank you. My pleasure.
He's reporting for the Talk Radio News Service. You can see more of his reports over at talkradionews.com, keeping us up to date on what's going on there on the ground. 28 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with your calls and thoughts on anything from Obamacare to sex education to what's up with the banksters.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And let us not forget tipping, and I got the Wing Nuts of the Weekend Racism Edition to share with you when we come back to it. Well, we don't really tie an arm behind my back, but we probably should. I mean, that would be great theater. This Wednesday, maybe I will. We'll see. Anyhow, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And they discovered gravitational waves. Scientists at Harvard University have discovered this. Albert Einstein, back in 1916, when he laid out his general theory of relativity. And I don't recall if he was still working at the patent office at the time or not. He was a clerk, you know, while he was developing some of this stuff. But Einstein said that in order to account for everything in the universe, you have to have waves of gravitation. And they'd be very small, very subtle, and very omnipresent. And it turns out that they are, all of those things, and that some of the ones that they've detected may even be the original waves of gravity from the Big Bang. It's a fascinating time to be an astrophysicist. A lot of amazing stuff coming up. Okay, tipping in the minimum wage, drug testing welfare recipients. This is absolutely insane. How the government botched its effort to hold Wall Street accountable after the crash. Oh, the wing nuts of the weekend racism edition from DU. I was going to share that with you, and then I'll pick up your phone calls. This is an actual candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives in Arizona, Republican. His name is Jim Brown. And these are, well, actually, let me give you James Bowman first. He was reviewing, this is the official movie review of 12 Years a Slave in the American Spectator, the conservative magazine. All caps, propaganda. Partial and one-sided. Yes, there was much cruelty and hardship in the slave-owning South, but it strains ordinary credulity to suppose that there was nothing else. Oh. So white guy Jim Brown, running for Congress in Arizona, he says, quote, slaves were kept in slavery by denying them education and opportunity, not by beating them and starving them. Although there were isolated cases, of course. Basically, slave owners took pretty good care of their slaves and livestock, and this kept business rolling along. Well, that's the point, that they were treated like livestock, that children were sold apart from their families, that wives were sold away from their husbands, I mean, on top of the beatings and the brutality. And then, of course, Paul Ryan, the GOP's new wunderkind. We have got this tailspin of culture in our inner cities, in particular of men not working and just generations of men not even thinking about working and learning the value and culture of work. So there's a real culture problem here that has to be dealt with. Yeah, let's blame it all on black men, which is what Paul Ryan's doing. The sad thing about this is that the Republican Party continues to win elections with this stuff. I mean, that's the really, truly sad thing about it. By the way, NASA has funded a study that has concluded that industrial civilization is headed for an irreversible collapse. New study sponsored by NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center has highlighted the prospect that global industrial civilization could collapse in coming decades. Why? Unsustainable resource exploitation. Principally, we can't keep pulling all these fossil fuels out of the ground without destroying our environment. And increasingly unequal wealth distribution. So when are the Koch brothers going to come up with a scary Uncle Sam to talk about this? Gary in Mount Hermon, Louisiana. Gary, you want to talk about sex education?
Yes, sir. I wanted to talk about that fellow you had on earlier about not having sex education in the schools.
Right.
First of all, I want you to understand that the lawmakers are not the citizens. The lawmakers are all paid off by the oil companies and all, and don't really speak for the rest of us. You know, most of us, you know, definitely want sex education in school. We want a higher grade of education. He's even cutting off funds for colleges and stuff.
He being Bobby Jindal, your governor.
Yeah, joke around here. I know he's a joke around the rest of the country, too.
Yeah.
Is he
running for re-election?
Yes, sir, he's running for re-election, and then, of course, you know, for president, which is
right.
Kind of far-fetched, but...
Yeah.
I don't think he's going to be reelected. I don't think he stands a chance because, like I said, he's a joke around here, too.
Huh.
But
Very interesting. So you wanted to stand up for the good people of Louisiana and point out that just because they have y'all have crazy laws down there.
But we don't get the airplay on national TV as the lawmakers who are a bunch of clowns, you know, and do all the idiot things that make the national news.
Right.
So I just wanted to make that clear that we're not all a bunch of dummies here.
Okay, I got it, Gary. I believe it, too. In fact, I have some good friends who live down in Louisiana, and it's a lot to recommend that state, a lot of good people down there. Gary, thanks a lot for watching Free Speech TV and for calling in. From Gary to Gary in Los Angeles. Hey, Gary, thanks for listening to KPFK. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to talk about Obamacare, one particular specific topic, and that is the Estate Recovery Act of 1992 and its effect, impact on people over 55 who go on Medicaid. I heard on the rerun on Roy of Hollywood show last week, you talking to the so-called expert, Igor. And unfortunately, he really badly misinformed people. I've been looking into this because I'm over 55, and last year was a bad year for me. And if I sign up, they're going to put me on Medicaid. And the California law in regards to the Recovery Act would, in fact, mean that Medicaid is not free for me. I would be going into debt to the government.
Now, is that not only the case if you go into long-term nursing care?
No, that is not the case. If you're on Medicaid and you're over 55, your coverage and any services you have.
And you just go to the doctor.
Yeah.
It's a loan.
Yeah.
Gary, can you give me a source that backs that up?
Yeah. You can go on to the government of California's website and look up the Estate Recovery Act and California's law regarding that.
Okay.
That's where I look.
Okay, great. I will do that. If this is the case, it's something that really needs to be fixed, and we really need to raise hell about it. And I'm frankly astounded that the Koch brothers have not used that as a wedge to attack Obama. Although it's so egregious, if it's true that it's the sort of thing that I think that there would be a bipartisan consensus that needs to be fixed. Gary, thanks for the tip. We'll track it down and we'll get into this in some more detail as time goes on. Logan in Sarasota, Florida, you want to talk about sex ed? Yeah, okay. Tyrone in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Tyrone, what's up?
Yes. I heard you mentioned about unemployment and Paul Ryan talking about unemployment. In Detroit, starting with the suburbanization back in 62, when they was moving, that was a trade policy to move after World War II, to move all department stores and manufacturing, not just a manufacturing move to the suburbs, and built the suburbs around Detroit, moved them all out. And then with the blacks in the city, they cut off the mass transit. We had the first mass transit in the city. They cut it off. And also, they would not allow for low-income housing to be zoned. In 71, the Supreme Court gave the suburbs that right. But that's not all that happened to the city for Paul Ryan. And what's happening in Detroit, it happened all over the country in the areas where blacks moved from the south to the cities. Then they came with the immigration policy of 1965, and they amended in 68. When they amended in 68, they allowed for the immigrants to bring their families, and also the Small Business Administration, when you look at the statistical abstract, year after year, gave immigrants billions of dollars, would not give black business any money, and that's how you go to many cities that you have the immigrant business that's in black communities, yet though they tell you that the immigrants was natural entrepreneurs and had $5, and in 5 years they was millionaires. No, they was financed by the federal government. And Paul Ryan, those facts Paul Ryan cannot get around when he's talking about whether the blacks in the city are lazy, shifting dumb. No, it was the policies coming out of Washington, D.C.
Well, and that's many of those that you're addressing there, I don't have the details on, Tyrone, but there are you know, the redlining policies, for example, not lending into black neighborhoods. There's a long history of racial discrimination in this country that has led to the economic disparities. It's why black families have, you know, $5 for every, I think, $80 that white families have in the United States right now, in terms of wealth, in terms of household wealth. And it's just wrong. This is stuff that we should be doing something about rather than having people like Paul Ryan demagoguing around it and trying to turn it into a political stunt. Tyrone, thank you for the call. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the end.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And we'll be right back with more of your calls, my thoughts, and the news of the day right here on the Tom Hartman Program. And welcome back. Mike in Chicago, watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Mike, what's up? You want to talk about tips?
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I'm calling about tips. Personally for myself, my baseline is 20%, so it's either up or down from there. But I know a lot of people in the service industry, and they all pretty much say the same thing about certain types of people not tipping well. And I think by eliminating the idea of tips, or at least paying these people so that tips aren't mandatory, it levels the field for everybody. So, you know, it's hard to go in as a server and, you know, put out your best and then, you know, get a 5% tip or a 10% tip. Here, this way, you know, it's the same for everyone. And like in Europe, like as you had said, sometimes if you want to leave a couple extra bucks here and there, that's fine. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not insulting or anything in this, you know, where a couple extra bucks here in America, that would be insulting, especially if you're talking about a $50 bill.
Right.
So I think it's a good idea. You know, and I don't really think service is going to suffer because I pretty much what you said, it's going to be bad or good, regardless, because they don't know what the tip's going to be one way or the other. But it does, I do think that some servers actually do take attitudes towards certain individuals through the history of what they've known, what they've experienced.
Well, one of the things that I've heard is that servers tend to think that older people, people who are, you know, are retired and look like maybe they're retired and living on Social Security, that they are going to be bad tippers and therefore they're going to get bad service. Is that the case? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, at least for my mother-in-law was, yes. My mom, who used to be a waitress, wasn't like that because she knew what it was to be. To work in that industry, but my mother-in-law was, you know, when we go out, it was one of those things, she would leave a tip, but then my wife and I would slip in a few extra bucks.
Yeah.
When she wasn't looking.
Yeah, I always over-tip, just, you know, in part because I can, but in mostly because I worked as a waiter once, and it's like, you know, it's a crummy job, and you have to put up with a lot of real fools. You know, there's another word that I'd use, but I don't think I can say it on the air. In fact, I know I can't. You know, some of these folks who come in just, you know, with an attitude, particularly because I was working was Bob's Big Boy on Trowbridge Road in East Lansing, which serviced, you know, Michigan State University. And the people that it was particularly tough on the service staff, who was virtually all female, the waitresses, was when the jocks came in, the football players. And they would come in and act like they owned the place. They tipped poorly. They slapped the women on the butt. They just behaved abysmally. And I'm guessing that probably a lot of that has been cleaned up. This was back in 1968, but it's still a tough business. It's a tough business.
But you bring up a valid point that actually ex servers or people who have been in the industry or are in it do tend to tip better.
Yeah, I think so.
They know what it's.
Shane's nodding his head. He's worked as a waiter. I've worked as a waiter. It's like, you know, when you've been there and you've seen what it's like and the insane work. I mean, you know, running around and trying to keep track of things. You get it. You get it. These people are not just, you know, sitting around having a cigarette all day. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV there in Chicago. And don't forget, Free Speech TV is having their fundraising drive right now. Give them a call, 877-378-8669. We won't have another opportunity to ask for that in this show today, so please call them now. Tell them I said hi. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you. Danny in Elizabethtown, Kentucky. Hey, Danny, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? I just would like to call and just let the people know in Congress, especially GOP and the neocons, that just because you're unemployed doesn't mean you're lazy. I joined the Navy at 17, quit high school. I fled poverty from the hills of Virginia. Since then, I got a GED. I got a college degree, a Bachelor of Science in Computer Information Systems. I have certifications. And I got laid off last May, and I cannot find work in any state, and I'm willing to relocate. Right now, I'm in Kentucky going through a welding program that is killing, putting me in pain because I was retired from the Navy with two pins in my back. So now, ouch. I have to eat painkillers in order to weld.
Wow. And so the message that you want to convey is that just because you're unemployed doesn't mean you're lazy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I have a college degree.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah, it is. And this is, you know, the fact of the matter is that capitalism is a very, very imperfect economic system. And it tends aggressively to produce mind-boggling amounts of wealth for a small number of people and basically poverty for a large number of people and unemployment for a surprising number of people. And this, I mean, these were the conditions of Victorian England. That was raw capitalism, naked capitalism, the way it runs when it's unregulated. And FDR said, okay, you know, we're going to regulate capitalism. We're going to make it work. And when capitalism fails, it is the obligation of government to step in. So if capitalism can't provide a job to people, government will. And thus he created the WPA and the CCC and dozens of other, you know, typically three-letter organizations. And government did fill in that. And, you know, we basically haven't done that since the end of World War II. And, well, we haven't had a serious crisis like we have right now. I mean, what we have right now is pretty analogous to the Great Depression. And we should be, the government should be creating the equivalent of the WPA and putting people like you, Danny, who want to work but can't find a job anywhere in the country to work. Danny, thanks a lot for the call. Patrick in St. Charles, Illinois. You wanted to talk about sex ed, Patrick?
Good afternoon, Tom. Yes. I've listened this afternoon, and you've had a lot of disparaging things to say about the great state of Louisiana. I would point this out, Tom. 73% of African-American women in this country, ages 17 to 35, have children without a man in the house. And the majority of this group of people live in the cities that you and...
Where are you getting the statistic from, Patrick?
Sir, it's been on the news since the beginning of this year.
What, on Fox News?
Of, as one, and CBS.
Okay, so let's say that's the case. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that is?
25.
Why do you think that is?
Evidently, the sex education in the city of Chicago is not working so well.
So why do you think you have a high rate of unwed motherdom among African American women?
I have that answer. Public schools are not the problem. It's the foundation of a family that is the problem.
So it's their parents who are to blame.
Or lack thereof.
And why is that?
Why is that?
Yeah, why is it that people who live in our cities in poverty, who have darker pigmented skin presumably than you do, why is it that they are living in poverty?
Tom, in the public schools of the city of Chicago, more is spent per student in Chicago than I believe any place in the country.
So it clearly does not have to do with school spending. Why is it then?
It's the breakup and the breakdown of the family unit.
So why is the family unit breaking down?
In part because the government will not pay as much in will pay as much to a single mother if there's a father in the home as they would if he were not in the home.
So you're of the opinion that African American families are uniquely susceptible to a welfare system.
52% of Latinos, 24% of Anglos. Those are not good percentages for anyone.
This I have a really hard time with your statistics.
Setting aside
whether your statistics are right or not, if this is the case, this is a crisis for African American families.
Sir, I would agree.
And you're saying that the problem is caused by the government giving them money. Is your solution Paul Ryan's solution to stop giving them money?
No, Tom, I didn't say
What's your solution?
I'm saying that
What's your solution?
In part, the incentive is not to have a man in the house.
What's your solution?
The solution is to somehow mend in our country, in our society, the family unit across all races.
So how do we do that?
That's a good question, sir.
Ryan says tax cuts for rich people will do it. You think?
Your quotes with regards to what Ryan said are way out of context, and you know that, sir.
I quoted him verbatim without any ellipses whatsoever. Anyhow, Patrick, thanks for the call. I got some statistics to look up. Yeah. We'll be back. We won't be back. We'll be back tomorrow. Thanks so much for being with us today. And don't forget, if you want to have a functioning democracy, you've got to show up. It doesn't just happen spontaneously. It actually requires the participation of everyone out there. So please, look for opportunities to participate. Democracy needs you. Tag your end. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.